Case number 12-7133. United States of America, ex real, Stephen M. Shea, appellant versus Cellco Partnership, doing business as Verizon Wireless et al. Mr. Mead for the appellant, Mr. Waxman for the appellees.
May it please the court, my name is Chris Mead. I represent Key Tam Relator and appellant Stephen Shea. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. As this court said in its opinion in Batiste, the command of the first to file bar is simple. As long as a first filed action remains pending, no related complaint may be filed.
Now that was Dick.
Well, it's as close to controlling language as I didn't pull the trigger and call it controlling, Your Honor, in our brief. I can't tell you how tempted I was. The reason it's so tempting is because
I wrote it. Yes, you did.
And I was glad for that caution when I saw you on the panel. But in any event, in order to make it dicta, you had to find that the plaintiff in that case had waived something. And what you found he waived, or she waived, forgive me, was making a request for an amended complaint, right? Which means that the amended complaint confers a right. So I came real close to saying it's controlling, but if you don't like your own opinion, if you don't like your own opinion, you've got the Seventh Circuit, you've got the Fourth Circuit, you've got the Tenth Circuit. The only case that Verizon cites is a District of Georgia opinion that strangely did not realize that there were two circuit courts' opinions out there. The court thought it was a case of first impression. And so I think with respect to the plain language argument that Verizon is making, that's a dog that won't hunt. I mean, if you delete the word pending from the statute, then it has the meaning that they say. So immediately you walk into the word is superfluous, canon of construction.
Can I ask a factual predicate question, which is because the premise of what you're saying is that these actions were overlapping in the same court before the same judge, did you think about amending the complaint in the first case, and why is there a reason that that couldn't have happened?
That's a great question, Your Honor. So first, I wasn't representing Mr. Shea at that point. He was represented by the most experienced false claims act counsel in the world, Phillips and Cohen. And your question illustrates how bizarre it would be that the result of this case should turn on the decision about whether you amend an existing complaint or bring a second case. And so obviously the thought process that goes into amendment versus a second case is a little tough in the false claims
act
context.
It doesn't seem that bizarre because in the mind of cases, you're not going to have the same party. What makes this case interesting is that you actually have the same party.
Right.
So it would, then the question of amendment necessarily arises. And was there a reason that it couldn't be amended, or it?
No. It could have been amended. But remember what happens in False Claims Act procedure. That triggers an additional requirement of the government to investigate the new allegations before it can resolve the first one, so that if you are a False Claims Act plaintiff eager for resolution, which is what we all want, there are some complications involved in amending versus bringing a second case. And I'm reasonably confident that the lawyers representing them at the time never occurred to them that this bar could apply to the same relator. As a matter of common sense and statutory construction, we've made the argument that it shouldn't apply to the same.
You don't have to win on that.
Thank goodness, yes, right.
I'm
here for small victories.
Common sense and construction, quite honestly, wasn't the most persuasive part of your brief. That statement that sentence couldn't logically refer to the same relator because they couldn't intervene, they could not bring a new action, does not cut any ice.
Well, it doesn't...
I read your statement many times, and I thought of all the different hypotheticals where you're using a disjunctive, and only one of the potential actors can meet both qualities, or each one meets different. It happens all the time.
It doesn't cut the ice all the way through, but it tells you what the drafter was thinking.
Well, scratched it, honestly. If Congress meant to exclude everybody, including the original relator, except the government, how would they phrase the sentence any differently than they phrased it right here?
When a person brings an action under this subsection, no person other than the government may intervene. So when, as the drafter, the fact that intervene comes before new action tells you what the drafter was thinking about. The drafter was thinking about other people.
I don't know that it does. They say in one order or the other, intervene or bring a new action. And it says nobody other than the government. It doesn't say the government and the original relator. To get your construction, you'd have to put some more words in there.
Well, I would put it to you this way. Let me flip the argument on you. The Fifth Circuit in Bailey said, read the provision clearly the other way, and two circuit court opinions admittedly
dictated. I understand it can be read that way, but it's certainly not a compelling plain language argument, and I don't think even a very good logical argument.
Well, so if you don't like the plain language argument, what I'd argue to you is that Bailey is controlling precedent, that the plain language argument can't possibly be in their favor, right? I mean, remember, the district court said, in her mind, the statute was plain, too. And that can't be right if Bailey goes the other way and two other circuit courts in dicta go the other way.
No. There were no successive claim problems in Bailey. Right. We just had a transfer. It's an opposite.
It is slightly different, but remember...
It's incredibly different. I mean, not slightly different. You can't rest on it. If that's your best argument, it doesn't work.
Well, all I say to you is, if the Fifth Circuit is right, that... Remember, the case law is pretty clear from Lujan and others that the first-to-file bar has no exceptions. If that's true, the Bailey lawyers were cleverly taking advantage of a statutory argument that the Fifth Circuit bought off on. I understand that the facts are different. I get that. But the difficulty is the Bailey court could not have reached the decision it did without saying, we read this statute not to apply to the same relator. Now, I must confess, Your Honors, that the first-to-file bar, when we talk about it that way, the defendants have already won a battle of nomenclature. It's not the first-to-file bar. It's the currently pending bar.
Was the action currently pending at the relevant time in this case?
Right.
So shouldn't the proper result, even under your view, be if we ignore that person argument that we've all just been playing with, shouldn't the proper result be not that we just reverse, but that we send back to make it a dismissal without prejudice rather than a dismissal with prejudice?
I certainly am begging for that result, Your Honor, so I don't want to disregard it. But I'd also like you to consider that even a dismissal without prejudice is not necessary. I think that's the minimum of what should happen on this appeal. But I don't think the defendant, remember, has to win on every single point we've raised. They have to win that it applies to the same relator. They have to win that... you look at the jurisdictional facts at the time of the initial filing as opposed to the time of the amended complaint, and they have to win that it's a related case. The first-to-file bar is about playing cricket instead of baseball. When one relator is up, when he is currently pending, he gets to hit until he's out. No other batter in the lineup gets to hit the game-winning RBI. It's only when that batter is out or quits that a new hitter gets up. And that's what the first-to-file bar is about. In 1986, Congress made a decided
pending
policy...
The case bar is what we're really talking about. I mean, I know you're saying that's nomenclature, but it's a very critical nomenclature that
it
what
is.
We're really talking about here is not exactly first-to-file, but really pending case.
Right.
And if they're right about pending case, I mean, if you're right about pending case, then you may win, but what you win is a change in the nature of the dismissal. Is that not?
That is true, but I'd also like to persuade you that in the unique statutory context of the False Claims Act, the ordinary rule that you consider jurisdictional facts at the time of filing should not apply. At pages 11 to 14 of our reply brief, we cited, I tried to look at it, I've done the research a million times, if you all can reconcile the conflicting case law where sometimes courts look at post-filing facts to confer jurisdiction, and sometimes they say, no, we're going to disregard post-filing facts.
So this is your argument that you should, the relevant time reference is the second amended complaint rather than the filing of the initial complaint?
Correct, because under this statute, remember, as a relator, I don't get to hit until after the government declines, right? It's only then, I understand the district court's point, and she is right. Of course, bring an action refers to filing a complaint. I get that. But it also, there's an and, it also can refer under False Claims Act procedure to filing an amended complaint, serving it, and
so
proceeding.
Here's my question about that, and go away from the text for a second.
Right.
I understand her textual argument on that. But as a functional matter, if the second amended complaint is the relevant time frame, then you'd have a situation in which, and you don't have a situation in which it's the same party.
Right.
Then you potentially have a situation in which there are multiple relators who are in the case who are competing for the same pie. Now, if you dismiss it and then require refiling, you don't have that problem. And so isn't one of the advantages to thinking about it in the way that the other side does, or at least that you don't have this problem of multiple relators in the case seeking a piece of the pie, which seems to be one of the policy rules underlying the first-to-file doctrine.
I was confused by that argument when Verizon made it, because it does not seem to me to be inconsistent with the argument that also bring an action also refers to filing an amended complaint and serving it after non-intervention. There's nothing inconsistent with saying, but while it was under seal, it was also pending. In other words, the pendency of the first unamended complaint under seal still would occupy the field, would still force the application of the currently pending bar, and the fact that we amend later simply means, all right, from that point forward, now we've got a new complaint, and that is what is currently pending and occupies the field. I don't get the gap. But
if it's a different relator with the second, who files a second amended complaint, then you have more than one relator in the case who are going to be asking for part of the proceeds. Is that not right?
So I understand your hypothetical. Mr. Shea has filed his second complaint while the first one is pending.
Yeah, and assume that the first one is not Mr. Shea.
Okay. And so that first case gets resolved, right? So now we've got an unamended complaint that remains pending after the first one was resolved. It is what I'm trying to argue is that because of the unique procedure, you shouldn't look at the jurisdictional facts at the time of filing necessarily. You should look at it at an appropriate time in False Claims Act procedure. I would still argue that no gap exists because my unamended complaint still occupied the field. When I file an amended complaint, my case is still active, has never stopped being pending, so no second relator should be able to join in. And I understand the point. You know, in other words, we're all seeking logic and consistency. It's so easy to say, doggone it, jurisdiction exists on the first day, and if not, the case is gone. And I get the logical imperative. We're all good students. We want the world to be orderly. But in reality, the cases aren't orderly. Look at Matthews versus Diaz. Look at your opinion in Simpson versus Libya. I mean, I don't know if you recall that case, but you wrote it. If you remember, this woman had been... I got you. You'll have to forgive me for ambushing you with that one, but it wasn't our brief. If you remember the facts in Simpson, and admittedly it's a different statute, but the whole point here is that all those cases turn on the specific statute that's involved when you're talking about what period you look at for post-jurisdictional facts. And all I can say is, if you guys can reconcile that conflicting case law, God bless you. I can't. What really happens is that the courts look at the specific statute, and I think they try to do justice. And in this situation, under the False Claims Act, I think it's bizarre to say that the currently pending bar applies to the same relator. I think it's bizarre to say that it is a controlling event that we filed a separate action instead of amending the first. None of that makes any sense from judicial efficiency. And then you've got two district court judges, the one in Chauvinec when that case was remanded, and Judge Hollander in Baltimore. Practical trial judges, you know, if I dismiss, it's going to be without prejudice. They can refile tomorrow. Why are we doing this? And that's the question I'd ask you about remanding to dismiss without prejudice. And then I got to figure out what date can I refile? When does the mandate expire? You know, and do I miss that date by one day and then get bounced again?
Are there statute of limits implications if the prescription here is that you refile because it's directed to be a dismissal without prejudice?
I mean, I am terrified about the procedural implications that I haven't even thought about. I mean, as you know, there's
a
real...
Would you make an argument that the statute of limits should be told or something?
As you know, there's a big battle going on about whether there is any statute of limitations at all with respect to the False Claims Act. You know, as a relator, I'll jump on that. But I'm sure they have very creative arguments that may have force, and I'd prefer to avoid having the district court judge go through that. I'd prefer to avoid it myself, and I sure don't want to lose on any of those arguments. So it may have implications. I see my time is up. If I'd like to reserve time for rebuttal.
May it please the court. This suit is jurisdictionally barred by both the first to file and the public disclosure bars. As to the first to file, Shea's second complaint is plainly a related action because it merely extends to additional Verizon contracts that he found on the internet, the same theory of fraud that he identified in his first action. And the court was correct to dismiss the suit with prejudice. The purpose of the first to file bar is to prevent QTAM relators from collecting bounties where the government has already been put on notice of the alleged fraud. And that purpose would be affirmatively disserved by reading a temporal limitation into the bar. Dismissed or not, the Ninth Circuit explained in Lujan, the first action, quote, promptly alerted the government to the essential facts of a fraud scheme, thereby fulfilling the goal of the first to file bar.
Can I ask you this question, Mr. Roth? If we disagree with you, and I'm not saying we will, but if we were to disagree with you on your argument as to pending, then was it incorrect to dismiss it with prejudice?
If you disagree with us on pending, it was incorrect to dismiss it with prejudice under the first to file bar, but right. There is an independent jurisdictional bar posed by the public disclosure bar, as to which this court's review is de novo. It was fully briefed and argued below, and there are no facts in dispute. This is a particularly easy case for application of the public disclosure bar. But as to this
as
pending
to the first
point,
file, yeah.
I have quite a few things to say arising
sure.
out of the colloquy between
yes,
Judge
Very Sen- briefly on that, granted, it is de novo, and we can take it without the district. We generally don't, though. Is that not the case? I mean, rarely do we grant a summary judgment on a different theory than the district court has.
I, as familiar as I am with this court's jurisprudence, I'm not prepared to say whether it's generally done or not. This is a particularly compelling case to do it. This litigation has been pending forever. They're all the relevant material facts are in the complaints and in Mr. Shea's deposition. And you're just going to have it back again after Judge Kessler rules. So we would urge the court to do it. And in fact, the court could address it without addressing the question of exactly what pending means. But as to that, I'm confident that we need to spend some time talking about that. I think it's very revealing that my friend says, well, it shouldn't be called the first to file bar. It should be called the, quote, currently pending bar. I want to make two observations about that. Number one, it doesn't say currently pending. What the meaning of pending, there's no question about what pending means, and there's no question that Verizon One is no longer pending now and wasn't pending when he filed his second amended complaint. The meaning depends on at what temporal point is the statute looking at. And the statute tells us that. The statute says it applies, quote, when a person brings an action under this subsection. And it then says when that has happened, there is a consequence. The consequence is that no person other than the government may bring a related action. And related action, what a related action is qualified by the words that follow it, which is it is an action that is based on facts underlying the pending action. Now, if the word, the, a couple of points. First of all, if you substituted the for that, just change the definite article before pending, I don't think there would be any question that our reading is correct, which is that the adjective pending was inserted in order to help the reader understand which of the two previously mentioned, quote, actions in that sentence it refers to.
I'm not sure that that's right, because even if you substituted the for that, it still would be that pending action. And I understand that it's making more clear that it's which of the actions it's referring to, but it still has the word pending in it.
Right, and the question is pending when? The temporal, they say pending means currently pending or is pending. But unlike 28 U.S.C. Section 1500 that was at issue in Keene, or the Medicare statute that referred to that, where the statute uses the word is pending, there is no tense here. And the tense, therefore, has to be understood both in terms of what the word pending is doing and also understanding what the purpose of this bar is. Now, as to that, I have two points.
That we would be running crosswise of two other circuits if we said the
We
will do that.
Well, let me suggest a couple things, and then I'd like to get back to the point about what this court has said the policy is and what Congress has said about this. The three circuits that my friend identifies are, I understand you can do whatever you will, and I frankly believe since the Supreme Court has this issue pending on a CVSG from the Fourth Circuit case, it could well use some help in having at least one court of appeals actually engage with the arguments that are being raised here. There are a couple of things to be said about those three cases. First of all, in none of those cases did the court consider the textual policy and legislative history arguments that we made. In fact, even in Batiste, it wasn't briefed at all. There was just a concession that pending meant still pending, and since it wasn't a basis for decision, there was nothing going on. The same thing was true in the Seventh Circuit in Chovanec. It was conceded. But as to those three, and so not a single one of them resulted from actual briefing on the points that we briefed to Judge Kessler and we have briefed here. In the first case, natural gas, the In Re Natural Gas litigation, the Tenth Circuit addressed this point not as a disputed point per se. The question in that case was, what does related action mean? And the court was considering whether or not to adopt or dissent from the views expressed by this court in Hampton and later in Batiste that a related action is an action that includes the same material elements, which, as this court has said, means, in other words, if the earlier complaint sufficed to put the U.S. government on notice of the fraud alleged in the second action, or, quote, equipped the government to investigate. And the Tenth Circuit said, we are not following the D.C. Circuit and the other courts of appeals on this. And a reason we're not following it is that because pending means currently pending, it would make no sense to apply a notice bar standard, because obviously once the original first-to-file complaint is filed, the government is on notice. It doesn't matter whether it's dismissed and then refiled again or anything like that. So in other words, the Tenth Circuit's reasoning is actually underscores why this court's jurisprudence requires it to adopt the understanding of pending that we've articulated here. Now, the other
two, your understanding of pending, what does this add to the other res judicata and the public disclosure bar, which already deal with circumstances in which you'd have an action that's barred because of another action that's
different. I mean, as to res judicata, I mean, the purpose of the first-to-file rule was included in the 1986 legislation at the instance of the Justice Department, which was concerned, notwithstanding the public disclosure bar and notwithstanding principles of res judicata, that the liberalizations that Senator Grassley and others were urging would in fact allow subsequent relators to come in and inappropriately share the recovery that the United States obtained, either chose not to obtain or obtained for its own purposes as a result of a first complaint. Now, the public disclosure bar addresses something entirely different. The first to file rule says the question is, was the Attorney General of the United States, that's 3730A1, on notice of the fraud, actually on notice. It's not, is it buried somewhere in some committee hearing or a media report or the internet? Where that is the case, then there is a no exceptions jurisdictional bar for subsequent related actions. And there is no exception. The public disclosure bar says, okay, if the Attorney General of the United States didn't know this, you still can't bring it if it was publicly disclosed somewhere, unless you're an original source. If you're an original source, we will allow you to do it. In other words, as to the public disclosure bar, the first-to-file rule performs an important function because a second-to-file, the second person to tell the Attorney General about the fraud, doesn't get an exception because he was an original source. The purpose of the first-to-file rule is twofold. One is to encourage a race to the courthouse, or a race to the Attorney General, and the one who wins the race, and this goes to his same person point, the one who wins the race is under a statutory obligation reflected in 3730A2 to disclose to the Attorney General substantially all of the information or evidence that he has. So it's to incent a race to the courthouse and full disclosure of everything you know about this fraud. And on the other hand, as this court has repeatedly pointed out, and that Congress has pointed out, is to prevent subsequent relators from sharing in the government's whatever recovery the government chooses to obtain for fraud committed upon itself. And that's why the bar has no exceptions and why there's no original source.
Now, as the subsequent relators, they're out because of public disclosure anyway.
Well, not if they're an original source. Right? In other words, Somebody comes in, I come in and say, oh, I've been doing all sorts of research and, you know, I got an MCI, memo that told me this, and Attorney General, Here's everything I know. I'm the first to file.
Right. And then the question
somebody else comes in and says, hey, I wrote the MCI memo. I'm an original source of that information. The first to file bar doesn't have an exception for that because the point of the first to file is the person who puts the Attorney General on full notice of the fraud gets the bounty and other people don't get the bounty. And as to this point,
so then why have the original source exception in the public disclosure?
Because it addresses, the public disclosure bar addresses circumstances not where the Attorney General of the United States has been told about a specific fraud and instances of it. It addresses, is it in a committee hearing? Is it on the internet? Is it, someplace else? If the Attorney General has been told about it, the teller is the original relator and subsequent related actions are barred so long as they're related. And this one plainly is related. I mean, one other thing to note about this, quote, pending language is not only is it telling that no one, including Congress, ever conceived of this as the currently pending bar. If you, and I realize that there are, some people whose religion causes them to doubt legislative history, but to anyone in this courtroom who might not follow that faith slavishly.
I was remaining silent.
Faithfully. You know, the House and the Senate reports that accompanied this provision described it without any reference to some on-again, off-again temporal limitation. They just said that the purpose of this is when somebody brings an action, no other person can bring a related action. I mean, the notion that this adjective pending has the kind of enormous jurisdictional significance that is completely inconsistent with the purpose of the first-to-file provision, I would suggest is an argument that, to coin a phrase, is that Congress has hidden an elephant in a mouse hole.
I realize you were not coining.
Didn't I say plagiarize a phrase?
I plagiarized it first.
To use a phrase. And so, therefore, we think that our reading of pending, that is, that pending action, the action that is pending when the bar is triggered, is the correct meaning and the only meaning that is actually faithful to the what everybody understands to be the purpose of this provision. I would say, you know, if the court has questions, I would offer a couple of rebuttal responses on the other two points that my friend has raised, that is it the original complaint or the amended complaint, and does it apply to the same relator? But I see that I'm out of time.
I have one question for you that's unrelated to those two while we have you up here, which is the predicate of your argument is that the first to file bar is jurisdictional. And I take the point that that's been the prevailing wisdom. Can you help me with one thing, which is that the statute says when a person brings an action under the subsection, no person other than the government may intervene or bring a related action. And it seems odd to me to label a provision as jurisdictional where it deals with the prospect of intervention, because I don't know what it means to say there's no jurisdiction over an intervention, but maybe there's an easy answer to this, because that would suggest that the provision is not jurisdictional in a steel company sense, in which event, if the public disclosure provision is jurisdictional, some court would need to address that one first. So can you just speak to this particular point about intervention?
I mean, I fully take your point, and, you know, the only thing I can say about the jurisdictional nature of it is I believe every single court that has considered this, and many have, including this court in Batiste, have said it is jurisdictional. I also want to say before I address intervention, and I'm not sure that anything necessarily turns on this, because if it isn't, the public disclosure bar is, and you certainly can and should address that. And even if it is, you can address the public disclosure bar. As to intervention, I acknowledge that it is a little odd to think about a jurisdictional bar against intervention, although I'm not sure that logically it's actually impossible or even implausible. I mean, if the court had said, you know, when a person brings an action under this subsection, no person other than the government, the court will not have jurisdiction over an intervention by, the court shall not accept jurisdiction over an intervention motion by a third party. I don't think we would view that as illogical or inconsistent with the notion of jurisdiction. Well, it's basically saying you just don't have power to consider a related claim, whether it's brought by a third party who's trying to intervene or whether it's brought in a subsequent related
action. Well, our case law applies standing to interveners. Article 3 standing requirements, jurisdictional.
Yeah, that's true.
Yep. That
is true.
That's not anomalous.
Unless the court has further questions, we'll submit. Thank you.
Ms. Thurman, did Mr. Mead have additional time for rebuttal? We'll give you 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Really quickly, you're right about the jurisdictional issue. I had to pick battles. He's right that every case talks about it jurisdictionally. Look at 3730E, which is the answer to the two critical arguments he made. 3730E1 and 2 have specific language. The court shall not have jurisdiction in certain cases. Congress did not use that language in the currently pending bar. But most importantly, you asked a critical question. What's the point of the public disclosure original source rule if you're right about the first to file rule? His answer was, because in the first to file rule, you bring it to the Attorney General and the Attorney General gets to decide. He is dead wrong. Look at 3730 E4-1. Okay? What it says is that those cases are barred even if the transactions or allegations, in the language of Hampton and Batiste, are disclosed in a federal, criminal, or civil case where the Attorney General is a party. He's dead wrong that the public disclosure bar doesn't contemplate the Attorney General getting notice. He's also dead wrong. There is no mention of notice anywhere in the legislative history about the first-to-file bar. Congress made a decision in 1986. It decided even when the government has the information, it frequently doesn't act. And we're going to say, same rule that applied with the British Navy. Why did they rule the seas? Because their captains and fleets got rich when they captured an enemy ship. And this is free market enterprise. Absolutely. The first-to-file bar says we're not going to have multi-party scrums. The public disclosure bar says, sets out the policy when we will allow a suit to be barred because the government has the information. And even when the government has the information, Congress made a policy choice. Somebody who's an original source, we want to bring detail to the government, even though it might already be known. This court has recognized that, and that's the public policy that Congress adopted in 1986. And they're arguing they want to go back to pre-1986. They want Venicare of the Florida Keys not to exist. $4 billion into the taxpayers' coffers as a result of this statute. One plaintiff's successive case.
Thank you, Mr. Mead. The case is submitted.